And welcome to the Theater Report. It is January the 9th, and I'm Phil Taylor, and we are live at 5. You know, you can tell, can't you? We're going to be talking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. I want to talk about developments in Pakistan, Afghanistan. But the big story of one of the big stories is developing. That is the one of the possible meeting between the president of Syria with president of Turkey, Erdogan. And we'll watch that very closely. This Turkey is a member of NATO, sort of. There's problems in that family, and that's good news for the world. But Turkey does not want Sweden to become a member of NATO unless and until they can behave like a fraternal state. That is to say, in Sweden, there are elements who are threatening the government of Turkey and involved in what Turkish government says is criminal activity in their country, and they expect cooperation from Sweden. We'll see if they get it. But we are getting now Zafar Bengash. How are you, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. I'm fine, thank you.
Good to hear your voice, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. To you, too.
By the way, I have an esoteric question, and I know it's not unfair to do this to you, because in baseball, as they say, you can hit a curveball. So Charmin Narwane urges us all to use the term West Asia. And I want to be, of course, asking you questions today about that region, and some say Middle East. But she's arguing sharply that we really ought to stop saying Middle East, because it's really Middle East is a measurement from London.
Yes, exactly.
And I believe maybe the leader of the Islamic Republic has spoken on that matter as well. But anyway, let's get your view. What do you think of Charmaine's proposal?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with her fully. In fact, we had many decades ago mentioned that this notion of designation of that region as the Middle East or Far East, etc., these are all very West-centric expressions, and the measurement is done from London, basically. If we refer to these regions, for instance, West Asia or Central Asia or South Asia, then we know what the Asian region is, mm-hmm. and then we can pinpoint the region that we are pointing to. So I'm in full agreement with that. West Asia is a much more accurate designation rather than referring to it as the Middle East.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. And by the way, it does point out, too, that how editors of journals and encyclopedias, there used to be such a thing, and dictionaries need to update their language. I mean, we find this all the time in a changing world. I've looked at the old British encyclopedias, and they called Islam Mohammedanism.
Yes.
Very, very authoritatively.
Yes.
But it's also, I guess, a sign of the developing world and dying colonialism, or the colonialism is, maybe I should put it this way, fighting for its life. And so I'm glad we talk about language at this point.
Yes, of course. And this is tied in with colonialism and imperialism, and this is part of the language of the colonialism that is thrust upon people. In fact, I can go further. I recall back in the 1980s, we were holding some courses in journalism in England, and this was being done in conjunction with the City University of London. And, of course, we had got students from all over the world, primarily from Africa and Asia. And on the first day, we would ask the students to write something about themselves, where they were born, etc., where they studied. And one of the most astonishing things that we discovered was that many of the African students wrote that I'm from such and such a village in such and such a country in Africa, and it was discovered by Dr. Livingston. And we would say to them, well, didn't your village exist before Dr. Livingston arrived?
Yes. Yeah.
So this was the kind of, you know, cultural imperialism that was being imposed on the thinking of people. And it's still very much practiced today when, you know, you read about that region that is referred to as the Middle East, and et cetera.
Yeah. No, it's very pertinent. And again, this is Zafar Bengash, a truly authoritative voice on such matters. And Zafar, I guess I want to ask you about what is maybe a story. It seems to be developing a possibility that's being talked about as between a meeting between President Assad and President Erdogan, and what that might mean. And I've seen some very positive comments saying if the two were to meet, and I guess this involves the removal of Turkish forces from Syria, that would really be a death blow or a major blow to the terrorists and their sponsors. What do you make of that?
Yes, of course. There was a meeting between the foreign ministers of the two countries, Syria and Turkey, under Russian auspices last week. That meeting took place in Moscow, and it was Russia that had brought the two foreign ministers together. Prior to that, there was a meeting of their defense ministers had met in Russia. And prior to that, their intelligence chiefs again had met in Russia. Now, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said that he would be, in fact, he issued a statement last week. He said that there is a possibility that there would be a meeting, his meeting with President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Now, I want to explain why Erdogan is so keen to meet Bashar al-Assad.
Mm-hmm.
The primary reason is that Turkey is going to have elections, both presidential and parliamentary elections, in June.
Mm.
And currently, Erdogan's party is not doing too well because the economy is in bad shape. And the people of Turkey has unfortunately soured on the 4 million Syrian refugees that are in Turkey. And they want these refugees to go back to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, they can't go back to Syria if there is a war going on in Syria. And Turkey has finally realized that the policy that he was pursuing at the behest of the United States and Saudi Arabia and others, that they wanted to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad, has failed. It has not achieved the desired results. All it has achieved is the death of something like 500,000 Syrians, at least a third of Syria's population turned into refugees, and of course enormous destruction of Syrian infrastructure. But other than that, neither Erdogan nor the U.S. nor Saudi Arabia or any of these other countries that were involved in the conspiracy to overthrow the government in Syria have succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Further, in fact, some of these Arabian regimes, particularly in the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, etc., they have already made peace with Bashar al-Assad and have established diplomatic relations with his government. Similarly, there are reports that the Saudi regime is also considering establishing diplomatic relations, but I think it's going to take a little while. I think once Turkey's relations with Syria are brought to some kind of a state of normalcy, then I think Saudi Arabia perhaps would also follow. So in all of this, essentially, if the two presidents, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria and President Erdogan of Turkey, were to meet, I think this would basically bring an end to this horrific, conspiracy that was launched against Syria and caused so much death and destruction. And that would also bring to an end these the terrorist groups that are operating in now confined to a small pocket of Syria in Idlib province. Still, they are an irritant, and they would also therefore be their nefarious activities would be brought to an end.
And what about that corner of that it seems to be so strategic, where it's a, spoken of as a region with a large percentage, I don't know if it's a majority, of Kurds near Iraq, where and where the Americans have their operation. Would that be, would the Americans have to close that down or quietly go away, or would they, what choice would they have to do, have in that situation?
Yeah, well, here's the situation. You're quite right that the Americans and the Israelis, incidentally, are deeply involved in supporting the Kurds in northern Iraq. And this is to the great irritation of the vast majority of the Iraqi people. And, of course, also of Iran, because it is from this Kurdish region in northern Iraq that a lot of weapons and a lot of terrorist groups are smuggled into Iran to carry out these terrorist activities in what was, in the Western media, it normally referred to as, protesters demanding women's rights, etc. They're not protesters. These are basically mercenaries acting at the behest of the United States and Israel, trying to create trouble inside the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they've carried out horrendous crimes, in Iran. They've murdered policemen. They have, in broad daylight, filmed on cameras. They have murdered...
yes, and the West calls them protesters.
They've set fire
we have casualties.
Banks,
we have people, police, and civilians killed by armed groups. And particularly, as you say, in that Kurdish region, and the media here insists on using only the word protesters.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at the news yesterday in Paris, there were literally tens of thousands of people protesting in Paris against government policies, against high energy prices as a consequence of France and Germany and Britain, etc., going along with this U.S. policy to not buy gas and oil from Russia, and America is supplying to these countries at four times the rate that Russia was charging. And of course, people in Europe are badly affected by that. They are not able to cope with the situation. And yet you see very little mention of that in the mainstream media. If they mention it, they just sort of present it as if these French people are, troublemakers. They are creating problems for Macron, etc. In Britain, for instance, The Economist itself, and The Economist is a very, very pro-establishment magazine, it reported last month that because of the increase in energy prices, there is likely to be at least 100,000 additional deaths in Europe as a consequence of these high energy prices. Mm-hmm. And in Britain, British newspapers have reported that some people are so badly affected by these high energy prices and food prices that people are forced to eat pet food. Can you imagine the plight of, and these are, I've lived in Britain when I was a student, and I can tell you that the elderly people in particular lead a very, very precarious existence. Mm-hmm. So you have that terrible situation whereby British newspapers themselves are now talking about people forced to eat pet food because they cannot afford normal food.
There was once a painting, Zafar, that was exhibited in Toronto. It would have been many years ago, and it was protested and taken down because someone had painted a can of cat food and a plate and a fork, and under it they wrote the Last Supper. And somebody said, "Don't do that." But I'm sure you're absolutely right. I mean, if right here in Canada, people are feeling it. I saw a cartoon in today's Toronto Star where someone is in the lineup. It says 8 items or more or something. And he says, who can buy 8 items or more?
Exactly.
So, yes, it's terrible.
I mean, I can tell you, you know, we go for grocery shopping every week. And the prices have absolutely skyrocketed. You know, I mean, a few weeks ago, a head of lettuce was priced at $7.99. Of course, these prices have come down since, but we simply refused to buy lettuce a few weeks ago. We said, okay, we can do without it. Mm-hmm. You know, $7.99 for a small head of lettuce, which is, you know, very soft, there is not much in it. It's really not worth it, and it's just astronomical. And you go down the list, whether it's eggs or anything else or any other, you know, fresh fruit or vegetables, etc. The prices have really, really, you know, gone up tremendously.
And this is traceable to a policy of hegemonism and of sanctions. A world where we have the Western powers say no, they will not cooperate with states that they deem to not have their values. I mean, we're in a very peculiar political environment where the other states, other nations are not respected. They're ordered, and therefore there's no cooperation.
Exactly.
And trade breaks down, and agricultural, you know, problems emerge. So, and I guess this taking this back, that here we are with Mr. Erdogan and President Assad, but as you tell it, obviously the other states in the region, I think maybe if there's a weak member of the family in the region, it would be Iraq, because Iraq still has American troops. But they all seem to be in alignment. Let's ask the U.S. and the British to go home, and let's call it West Asia.
Exactly. In fact, you know, the I can tell you that last week, on January the 3rd, there were massive commemoration ceremonies in Iran and Iraq. And this was the third anniversary of the brutal murder of General Qasem Soleimani, a very, very respectable general in Iran, as well as Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was the second in command of al-Hashd al-Shaabi. These were the resistance militias in Iraq. Both of them were murdered by a drone missile strike that was ordered directly by Donald Trump.
That's right.
When General Soleimani arrived in Baghdad on a flight from Syria. And these two commanders, as well as 8 of their comrades in a vehicle, were murdered outside Baghdad International Airport. Mm-hmm. Now, this was a war crime. In fact, the former UN rapporteur for extrajudicial killings at the time, Agnes Callamard, in her report to the UN Security Council, had categorically stated that this was a war crime, that Trump had acted illegally for a variety of reasons. Number one, he had violated Iraq's sovereignty. Number two, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was an Iraqi citizen, murdered on Iraqi soil by the Americans, when in fact the Americans claimed that they are Iraq's allies, that this was a war crime, and that that there should be punishment for the perpetrators. And as I mentioned last week, there were massive commemoration ceremonies both in Iran and Iraq, and their leaders have vowed not to forgive or forget the perpetrators of this crime, and that they will seek restitution for what has been done. Obviously, in today's environment, unfortunately, the various bodies that have been established, such as the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, mm-hmm. are not really institutions that can deliver justice to anybody.
No, they share America's values.
Exactly. And so what the Iraqis are working on is, and many Iraqi politicians of all persuasions have been quite clear about this, that they want all American forces out of Iraq.
Yeah, by the way, am I right that that was subsequent to that? That's when the Parliament ordered the U.S. to leave.
Exactly. And the U.S. actually
refused.
The
Iraqi Parliament.
The U.S. refused to do so. I mean, the Iraqi Parliament overwhelmingly voted to expel American forces. So what the Americans did was they said that, okay, we have abandoned our previous agreement with the government of Iraq, and now we are going to enter into a new agreement with the government of Iraq, of course, holding a gun to their head. And so that is, unfortunately, the situation. Although, you know, in my discussion with various Iraqi political figures, they are quite clear. They say that the root of our problems is, of course, the presence of American forces here, and they are creating instability, especially by instigating the Kurds in northern Iraq. But unfortunately, the Iraqi armed forces are not strong enough to take on the American forces, although I must say that the number of American forces has declined considerably, and now their presence is not very visible in Iraq. They remain confined to their military bases, and mm-hmm. there is a lot greater sort of diplomatic American presence. Although, strictly speaking, I think the Iraqi politicians should have been able to muster enough courage to tell the Americans, even their diplomats, to go home because mm-hmm. America had perpetrated a crime on Iraqi soil. Mm-hmm. in clear violation of Iraqi sovereignty, and Iraq should, and its leaders should, muster the courage to tell the Americans to get lost.
Yes. Now, and isn't it remarkable, and here we are, it's Monday, January the 9th, we're broadcasting live, CIUT 89.5, the Taylor Report, that our media today is talking about one of the tragic consequences of Trump's act of war, by the way, not just a war crime. It was an act of war to kill, as he said, he took credit, personal credit, it's not a mystery, for murdering General Soleimani and the Iraqi popular leader and others, and also notifying the Islamic Republic that if they responded, that America, he said, and again, I remember him doing it publicly, we have already targeted 52 places in Iran that we will strike. He told them that. So you had a war footing, and a civilian aircraft took off from Tehran and was shot down because the the officer who perpetrated it, my understanding is, mistook it, the plane for a missile. And we have reports in today's Globe, in Toronto Star, CBC, the Prime Minister holding a candle. None of them put any responsibility on Donald Trump, who fired the missiles that murdered General Soleimani and thus legally starting a war.
Exactly.
And with Iran having to, being the smaller power, being in a really difficult spot, 87 million, the U.S. has 800 bases around the world, has every weapon you can name. But nonetheless, they were prepared to fight. And as I believe they are yet today, there's no question about that. So, but no one here will tell the story in sequence so that it could be understood. There was a prominent Canadian businessman who lost a dear colleague or the wife of a colleague in that plane, and he issued a public, personal statement. He bought a page in the newspaper saying, all this is due to the outrageous behavior of an idiot president, basically, Donald Trump. And here we are now, 3 years later, and Trump's name is not mentioned in any of these stories about that tragedy.
This really is the crux of the matter, that these Western governments and the media, etc., are deliberately misrepresenting the reality of the shooting down of that plane. To put it into context, obviously, after the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, Iran was at an edge. It was obviously expecting that there may be more attacks from the United States and that Iran had to be prepared for every eventuality. So the local base commanders were given authority that if they detected any incoming missiles or hostile objects in the air, that they did not need to follow the normal rules of engagement by going through the chain of command right to the top to get permission. Mm-hmm. That the local commanders were permitted to take decision instantly. Mm-hmm. In view of the fact that General Qasem Soleimani had been murdered and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq, who was the senior commander of their militias,
yes,
and eight
and,
other people,
and
all
out of
military
the blue
personnel,
attack,
or,
by the way, with no forewarning, no nothing.
Exactly.
Simply a murder.
Absolutely. And so in that sense, the decision, regrettable, of course, of that local commander in Iran, that he mistook that plane, and that plane, incidentally, was heading towards the base. It should not have been heading towards the base. In fact, that plane, before it took off from Tehran International Airport, the control tower had told them that it is not an appropriate time to fly in Iranian airspace and that you should delay the flight. But that pilot of the plane insisted that he was going to take off. This is all documented, information. It's not something that has come up, recently.
Yeah. And in addition to that, the American Association, there's the one that advises American, all flights everywhere of their decisions about flying over war zones, when they put out warnings. And there was a decision not for no U.S. planes, for sure,
yes,
to fly anywhere in the region, anywhere, over the Gulf, anywhere.
Right.
Qatar and Singapore Airlines both grounded their planes in the region.
Correct.
Because they knew, anybody with two eyes or could hear, knows this is not a time to be flying anywhere. And because it's true, we left out a detail there. Iran actually knew they were being challenged with the death of General Soleimani. They said this: we will react, and they fired missiles. I think 11, maybe more, at a U.S. base, and that was considered everybody absolutely on edge because you don't fire at the Americans. The Americans fire at you, but you don't fire at them. And Iran, to show its resolve, did fire,
yes,
at U.S. bases. And then the big question was, are we going to ignore that? Because this is, the American rule is we pound on people who are smaller if we can. Incidentally, former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was bringing legislation. She immediately reacted to Trump, saying he shouldn't have the power to do these things. People are forgetting there was a debate at that time about Trump's conduct.
Yes, in fact, that debate is still, you know, in some members of Congress are still bringing it up, particularly with respect to the war in Ukraine, because quite a few congressmen and women, incidentally, are very concerned that America is getting deeper and deeper into this proxy war in Ukraine against Russia. Mm-hmm. And they fear that if this were to escalate, and there are all indications that this might escalate because the way the United States is conducting itself and its European allies, that a stage might be reached whereby Russia and America might get into a shooting war. Last week, you know, Russia was extremely upset because the Ukrainians had used missiles, American-supplied missiles, mm-hmm. that had targeted a Russian military base, yes. In which 89 Russian soldiers were killed. Their mm-hmm. barracks were hit by these American-supplied missiles, and President Putin reacted very angrily to it, and he reminded America that he had said earlier that if American weapons are used to target Russia proper, that Russia would take appropriate steps. Mm-hmm. And yet, here was a situation whereby American-supplied missiles were used by the Ukrainians to target a Russian military base inside Russia proper. So mm-hmm. this escalatory ladder that the Americans are involved in, and the Ukrainians are actually pushing for a situation whereby America would get involved directly. Although American, you know, advisors and trainers, etc., are in Ukraine, as there are British and French and German and other European countries, military personnel are present in Ukraine. And this situation is really becoming extremely dangerous. And mm-hmm. because of this, a number of U.S. members of Congress have expressed concern that these powers that the president has to declare war without seeking authorization from Congress need yes. to be curtailed.
Yes, and that was established at that moment. And, you know, here we are. It's really our job to remind you, get the story straight, get the sequence. If you do one thing, then another thing happens. That's the way it unfolded. And I want to mention to you, too, and I know this is close to your heart, it is to mine, that there was a flight in 1980, you could remember the time, the
1988.
An Iranian civilian aircraft flying to Dakar. On just simple, regular flight. The U.S. Vincennes warship, Captain Rogers III, fired a missile and shot it down, killing, I think, 299 Iranian citizens. And they gave that, 2 years later, he was given and a medal, a Legion of Merit medal.
Correct.
And he said, well, we misidentified it, but it was an honest mistake, and right. we're trying to keep our country safe. Seems to me that Iran ought to reach into the deck and pull that card out and put it to the Americans and say, what do you think is going to happen? You actually gave a pass to one of your ranking star naval captains for shooting down a civilian plane, 290 people on it, and you gave him an award of merit, and while admitting that it was a mistake.
Yes, and the excuse that they had made was that they thought it was an incoming Iranian fighter plane, Tomcat 14, yes. whereas in fact this was an Airbus, a huge plane
yes.
flying from Bandar Abbas to Dubai on a pre-assigned flight path. And this plane flew every week from Bandar Abbas to
on
Dubai.
Schedule. So it was not on schedule.
This was a completely known air corridor in which this plane was flying. And the American captain, Will Rogers III, as you mentioned, said that, you know, we thought that this plane was descending towards us, whereas in fact the plane was ascending. It was going higher up to
yes,
its
the Navy itself said he was mistaken. That plane was actually gaining altitude. It was in a pattern and was going, gaining
exactly.
altitude.
And a Tomcat F-14 is a tiny plane compared to an Airbus, which is a massive plane.
Those who worry about an accidental nuclear war, they should study that case.
Exactly.
Because everybody would be annihilated, and somebody would have a note saying, "I thought it was a Tomcat." That's it. You know, I did my best, sir. Oh, good.
And incidentally, the Vincennes did not fire one, but it fired two missiles at that plane.
Yes.
And just to make sure that it's completely obliterated. And I can also tell you that there were, one or two passengers on that plane that I personally knew. There were one or two, highly respected academics that I had, known during my visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran. One of them, incidentally, was a woman writer who was working on the translation of the Quran, and that's how I came to know her. Mm-hmm. And she was also on that flight, and of course, she was killed.
It's very important to tell these stories because there has been a weaponization of these tragedies. I'm very bitter about the coverage because I read that there were, they say, 55 Canadians on the plane, but there was 137 Iranians on the plane.
Yes, exactly.
And there was a total, I think, 176 passengers. So
that's right.
I mean, if you're going to claim that you care about the loss of life, you don't stop at the number 55. You mentioned that it's a tragedy that all 176 were killed. And by the way, each of those individuals has an individual story that no one is in a position to speak for them and say, oh, they would really dislike the government of Tehran, or they would dislike that. It's a tragedy, as they were killed in a war circumstance created by the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who everybody, by the way, claims to regard as mad. And if you read American media and all the major papers, they describe him as a criminal, as a billionaire, as a dissolute, corrupt. He's everything, except he's not responsible for what happened here.
Yes. That really sums it up very, very nicely, that in everything else, Donald Trump is a criminal. He attempted to lead an insurrection on January the 6th, 2020, and that he is considered a complete fraud, who is involved in tax evasion and all kinds of other misdemeanors. And yet when it comes to that terrorist act that he perpetrated by ordering the missile strike on that vehicle outside Baghdad airport on January the 3rd, 2020, then everybody is sort of, largely silent about this.
He didn't do that. It's like it didn't even happen.
That's right.
That's why partly when we do this program, and I often feel we're fighting insanity. We're trying to, it's like this, we're in an environment of selective hysteria. They get hysterical about certain things and don't notice that how one thing is connected to another thing. And I want to raise with you as an authority on these matters, Donald Trump walked away from the nuclear agreement, much sought after by practically every sane person, with the Islamic Republic. It was President Obama had dithered and dithered, but eventually had a deal. Trump takes office and tosses the deal out the window. And everybody said, well, now Biden is back. They're going to resume. But they're not.
Yes. Basically, that agreement was hammered over many years. And finally, the final touches were made in July of 2015. And then signed by both parties and ratified by the UN Security Council at the beginning of 2016. Under that agreement, Iran agreed not to enrich uranium beyond 3.67%, and whatever stockpile of uranium it had, it agreed to ship out to Russia, and that if it needed any enriched uranium for medical purposes, that Russia would supply those isotopes to Iran. In return for accepting these limitations, as well as intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which had installed its cameras on Iran's nuclear facilities, Iran was to get all of its money that was frozen in international banks. This was money that countries owed to Iran for its oil sales that was illegally frozen, and that all countries would trade with Iran freely. And yet, even at that time, despite that agreement, regrettably, the Obama administration or its Treasury Department privately told various European banks and multinational corporations, telling them that if you trade with Iran or if you deal with Iran, there can be likely consequences. Mm. So as a result of that...
So
that
with one hand they give and the other hand they take away.
Correct. Even Obama was not honest in his dealings.
What
and
do
of
you
course,
know?
When Trump came to power in May of 2018, he simply tore up that agreement and he said, you know, we don't accept it. Even though every year the International Atomic Energy Agency certified that Iran was complying with its obligations. Every year, 2016, 17, and 18. And yet Trump tore up that agreement. And Iran still waited for a whole year before it took remedial steps, because within the agreement there are articles 35 and 36 that clearly state that if any party withdraws from this agreement or violates the terms of this agreement, then the other party, the aggrieved party, has the right to take certain remedial actions. And one of them was that if let's say the United States were to not fulfill its agreements. It didn't even talk about abrogating the agreement. It simply talked about not fulfilling its obligations, that then Iran is entitled to start enriching uranium to a higher percentage. Now, Iran waited for a whole year before it started enriching uranium to a higher percentage. And yet, whether it's the Europeans or the Americans, under the present discussion, they keep on bringing up these ludicrous demands that Iran must not only not enrich uranium, but that Iran must not even make missiles to defend itself. Now, we know that nobody
connection between those subjects.
Yeah. That how on earth can any country...
In other words, do not defend yourself.
Yes, exactly.
To
Iran
satisfy
is being told that you can't defend yourself. Yeah. I mean, Iran's leaders would be insane if they were to accept this, because they have the example of, for instance, Iraq.
Libya,
exactly. Both countries that were first in Iraq, they kept on making allegations that weapons of mass destruction, even though the UN inspectors that included Americans kept on saying, Scott Ritter is one of them who who kept on saying, Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction. We have dismantled all of their facilities. And once the Americans were 100% sure that they had no weapons of mass destruction, then America unleashed its war in March of 2003, and they literally obliterated Iraq's infrastructure. You know exactly what happened to Iraq.
Yeah. And Zephyr, do you recall that someone very, I think maybe it was Noam Chomsky, who does not known for his sense of humor, but he said, they don't have them. If they did have them, you wouldn't attack.
Exactly.
You know they don't. That's why you're attacking.
Yes. And the same thing happened with Libya. You know, once Libya had abandoned all of its, I mean, it had a very, very rudimentary nuclear program, and it was nowhere, anywhere near making nuclear weapons, but Libya dismantled everything. And Libya was blackmailed into accepting that it was responsible for the downing of Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, and Libya paid something like $4 billion in compensation. Mm-hmm. Despite doing all of that, once they were certain that Libya was totally disarmed, then they went after Libya and basically smashed it to smithereens and lynched Gaddafi publicly in October of 2011.
And treated it as a public joke.
Yes.
A murder of a leader who was highly regarded in Africa. Very highly regarded in Africa, because he is a friend of Africa. He had provided more aid and assistance than any other state in Africa.
Exactly.
And they cackled that they had murdered him. By the way, I want to mention, apropos of this, isn't it a fact that this business of doing everything that the Americans want and getting nothing, didn't that affect the elections in the most recent elections, the Islamic Republic? People here don't know that they have elections, but they do. And weren't they affected by this posture?
Yes, this is absolutely correct. In fact, the people in Iran were so disillusioned by the duplicity of the Americans when the previous Iranian administration of Hassan Rouhani, which had signed this deal with the United States, and I can tell you soon after the agreement was signed and put into place, I had spoken to some Iranian academics who are close friends of mine, who are, you know, highly placed in universities, etc., and they have their finger on the events in Iran. They felt that this agreement will not hold because the Americans will not honor their obligation. So I asked them, then why does Iran want to continue with it? They said that, well, since we have signed the agreement, we want to remain faithful to our signature and to show to the world that the Americans cannot be trusted at all. And I think the people of Iran will also find this out very soon. And of course, within a year, by 2018, Trump had torn up the agreement. Yes. And it was as a consequence of that betrayal, that duplicitous action, that the people of Iran then turned to the present president and his team, because they felt that America is simply incapable of upholding any agreement. As, you know, President Putin also pointed out, he said that America is incapable of upholding any agreement that it signs. Mm-hmm. And so Iran had experienced this much earlier, and therefore the Iranian people decided to elect a government that would take a much more clear, principled stand for their own rights.
Yeah. And isn't that, and that becomes part of this pattern that we're seeing, that once again we do have developing countries, and we have, of course, Russia, we have the China, and there is a common, they do say in common, that the country that you can't trust now, because it doesn't live up to agreements, China, in the case of Taiwan, say, listen, you recognized Taiwan was part of China's. So why are you playing games with us? And in the case of in the Ukraine, there was a, when Ukraine became independent, there was an agreement they were going to be neutral, and they were not going to be part of any military alliance. That was agreed. That was part of the deal. And then the West just looks away, or they had the Minsk agreements, and they say, well, okay, this is going to be the solution. And then they're not implemented.
And, exactly.
And you know, you put countries on their own, they're thrown back on their own resources when they find that a deal is not a deal, that the West is going to say, no, we're the exceptional country, we've decided to tear up that deal. Well, then you have to be prepared really to look after yourself and not worry too much about the song and dance coming from Washington.
Yes. In 1990, when Russia and the United States were negotiating regarding the reunification of East and West Germany and the demolition of the Berlin Wall, James Baker, who was at that time the U.S. Secretary of State, he gave a categorical assurance to Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, that if Gorbachev were to agree to the reunification of East and West Germany, that NATO would not move one inch eastward. In fact, once, of course, Soviet Union dissolved in January of 1991, and the Warsaw Pact also dissolved, there was really no reason for NATO to exist. And yet we know that since that time, NATO kept on expanding,
yes,
bringing in more and more countries that were formerly...
Do you recall there was a phrase, what was it, the peace dividend?
Yes.
What dividend?
Of course, there was no dividend. There was
you know, they promised us too, not just Russia, but they promised us a peace dividend. Now we're spending more on arms than ever.
Yes. I mean, you know, the latest, you know, U.S. military budget, it's so incredible that Biden, this was 2 months ago, he sent the military budget for 2023 for asking for $813 billion. That is about 60 odd billion dollars more than the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
The Congress, in its strange wisdom and logic, instead of scrutinizing this $813 billion budget, they added another $45 billion to the budget to,
yes,
approve a budget of $858 billion for 2023.
Just like drunken gamblers.
So you can see...
I put more chips out there than you did.
Exactly.
Just to say...
And the reason is
I'm more patriotic than you.
See, these you know, weapons manufacturers basically pay these congressmen and women, and also if there are, let's say, industries set up in their particular states, then they get benefit out of that. So they keep on shoveling billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. And also, over the last 20 years, audits carried out of Pentagon budget,
oh boy,
they found out that the Pentagon cannot account for $2 trillion. There are no receipts of where that money has gone.
Yes.
And nobody is, you know, bothered about it.
And they've been asked more than once, can you please give us, and they have deadlines to account, and they're missing the deadlines.
And this just continues, and then the same Congress keeps on shoveling more money to the Pentagon. And so this is this strange kind of situation.
Yes. And one great power has a serious problem.
The real tragedy is that, you know, when you have so many weapons, then obviously you need to have wars in order to use, mm-hmm, those weapons so that you can then manufacture more weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a number of American commentators have said that war is a racket, and that's what America indulges in.
Indeed. Well, with 800 bases around the world, and it's quite easy for an officer somewhere to create a crisis just by firing a shot. And since every time America fires a shot, they're in the right, they couldn't be in the wrong. So that means you have to give him 10 times whatever it was he wanted before. Just absolutely remarkable situation. Zafar, you've been conducting a seminar. We really appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure, Phil.
We need to circulate this. We might even print it up for our listeners because you've covered so many matters, and we look forward to it. I want to come back in the future. We're definitely watching the Syria situation and what it means for the region. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Zafar Ben-Gaish. And that's Crescent International. Look him up.